Hello and welcome to the King's Cast. Chemicals surround us, from our cleaning products to our pesticides to the antifreeze in our cars. But where do they come from and how do we know they're safe? Here to discuss the practicalities of chemical experimentation and the significance of good practice is Claire Gamblin, Managing Director of Agrochemex Environmental, Chris Ramsden, Head of Ecotoxicology and Study Director at Agrochemex Environmental, and Donna Bodsmith, Deputy Curriculum Leader of Science here at the King's School. Hello and welcome to you all.
Hello.
So can I start off, please, by asking Claire, would you mind giving us a bit of context? So why do we experiment? Why do we need this process? Who asks for it and that kind of thing?
So you mentioned earlier that chemicals are all around us, and so any one of those chemicals could get into the environment. So you've got pesticides that are sort of directly exposed into the environment because they're sprayed onto crops or turf, or you've got things that might get into the waste system, so pharmaceuticals, veterinary products, and then you've got other things that could be, say, shipped in tankers, and then maybe there'll be a spillage. So it's really important to understand that if that happens, if they do get into the environment, what the impact of that is. So there are different regulations governing each of those areas, and there are different regulatory bodies in each country. But really what they're interested in is, say you've got an invertebrate or a fish or a bird, how is it going to affect the population of those if that chemical gets into their environment or into their feed, for example? So we as a company, we're a contract research organisation, and we are therefore independent of the chemical manufacturers. They contract work to us, so you could have people who manufacture pesticides or pharmaceuticals. They're all required to do this environmental safety testing, and they would ask us to look at the safety levels. Chris will come on to in a bit the sort of practicalities of that, but we have certain model species that we work with, because then you can make comparisons with other things that have been tested previously. So you can apply safety levels to that and look really at if the population could recover, or if it's going to be completely wiped out, or if it's in some cases potentially going to increase it. So algal blooms might be a consideration. You've got something that gets into a watercourse, causes an algal bloom. Do you suffocate everything else that's in that body of water?
Can I ask, so who is it that asks you as a company? Is it the government? Is it farmers? Is it the people who are, for want of a better phrase, designing these chemicals? Who is it that instigates these studies?
Well, the regulators ask the companies that manufacture them to do them. So there's a regulatory requirement. They're ultimately asking for them. But the people that ask us directly are the people who manufacture the chemicals. Or the ones that want to market it. They might be making the chemical, or they might be reformulating it. So they've got a responsibility to provide safety data in the form of a dossier to that regulatory agency to say, please, can I put my chemical on the market? It does what I said it's going to do. It works, but also it's not going to kill off all the worms. It's not going to completely decimate the environment around it. So our customers are the chemical manufacturers, and they are legally obliged to do a certain set of tests. And that will vary depending on what the chemical is that they're testing. So, you know, something that's, say, a herbicide getting into the environment, is it going to kill off all of the wildflowers that surround the edge of the field? People are very concerned about only treating the target. So you're getting the weeds that are in the crop, not everything else that surrounds it. So that's really important for biodiversity. So there's different requirements for different chemicals. With pharmaceuticals, for example, you're never going to take them off of the market if they're really efficacious for humans. you're just going to control how they are disposed of. So the main route of them getting into the environment is by the waste system, whether it's the packaging or human waste. And you therefore understand what the safety profile is and try to control those elements, opposed to actually saying you're not using it at all. So they might have to be incinerated, for example, instead of just put in the bin.
Can I ask as well? You mentioned there about regulations and different regulations for different chemicals, depending on their use and that kind of thing. Have you seen much change in those regulations? You mentioned about the wildflowers, for example, around the edges of fields. Have you seen a shift in attitudes to chemical application?
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of chemicals have been taken off the market. So the tests that we do haven't necessarily changed dramatically, although sometimes we all do tests that we used to do on crops. We might do them on weed species because they're interested in that wildflower population. But what we are finding is that the levels that you're allowed, so what they term a regulatory acceptable concentration, have decreased. So what's allowed to be in the environment has gone down, and therefore companies are obliged to either make their formulation more effective. So if it's a herbicide, if it gets onto a leaf of a weed, you need less of it to kill that weed because you can get more of it into the weed. Or they are more targeted. So you'll get sprayer systems that are on tractors that have low drift nozzles. So they're trying to keep it so that it's only on the crop. It's not drifting off. Or they'll put measures to say you can't apply this after sunrise because the bees are flying after that. So you've got to do this particular compound in the dark because it does its thing, and then the bees can feed on the flowers of that crop during the day. So they're tightening up from all different angles, opposed to changing the test that we do. I think it's what's done with the data is slightly different compared to actually what we're generating.
They're tightening down. So there's these regulations under REACH. Mm. So what you used to be able to produce, let's say 100,000 tons of a chemical, and you didn't have to do any tests. A few years ago, they introduced in 2018, I think, yeah, it was, the regulations came in, so that every 5 years or thereabouts, they get tighter and tighter by an order of magnitude. So if you could do 1,000 tons last year, in 5 years next time, you won't be able to do 1,000 tons without doing the testing. So they're getting tighter and tighter and more sort of controlled on what chemicals are being manufactured in what quantities, and then they trigger, okay, this time around, you need to now test because you're producing enough of it to test.
And that leads into shipping requirements and container requirements when they're being shipped, sort of labelling, containing things so that they don't get the spillages, and knowing what to do if they do, how to deal with that.
Thank you. Can I move on, sort of thinking about that, not just safety, but the practicalities of stuff. So, Donna, would you talk to us a little bit about what is it that makes a sound study, a sound experiment? What are the fundamentals of that?
So when we're talking to students in science, the big thing that we talk about is how do you produce valid data? So how do you make sure that however you're carrying out your experiment, at the end of it, the data that you get is valid, it's reliable, and it's accurate. So we talk about how do you control all the variables. So, for example, if you are interested in the impact of these different metals, for example, how do you make sure that everything else you keep exactly the same, so you are absolutely certain that the results that you are given are accurate and they are valid, whereby it was definitely that metal that affected your results. It wasn't the fact that you measured 2 grams this time and 1 gram the other time, or it wasn't the fact that you slightly measured too much of your acid that you were reacting. You are absolutely certain that that was the only variable. So we really, really focus on that accurate, that valid data, repeatable, and also the planning of it. So making sure that students know how to plan an investigation and follow a method accurately.
Fantastic. You mentioned there about variables. Why is it so important that, about it being, you can repeat it. Why is that so important in the process of testing things? Why should you be able to repeat it?
Well, if you don't, so for example, if you do something once, you have no idea if that was what we call an anomalous result. You'd have no idea. However, if you do it five times, four of them follow a similar pattern and one of them doesn't, then you're like, oh, hang on a minute, I must have done something wrong that time. But you wouldn't have a clue about that if you only did it once. So we really focus on that repeating, because at the end of the day, we're humans, things do go wrong. We repeat to make sure that what we're saying is right and that our data is accurate, and we're minimising that effect of random errors.
So is that through the way that you record it, through like documentation of planning? Because I mean, obviously, I'm not a scientist, so my memory of experimenting in school was Bunsen burners and test tubes and that kind of thing. I remember the practical stuff. I remember the bits and pieces. Sadly, I don't remember any of the paperwork that I did. So the recording of it, the documenting of it, in terms of science as a field and as an industry, that's, I suppose, just as important as the physical testing itself then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's really, really important that they repeat, especially if you think of science in the real world, if you like, when scientists are publishing data. If they haven't had it, if they haven't repeated it, or they haven't checked that it's reproducible, as soon as someone else comes along and does that study and finds they get different results, they're going to be discredited. So you've got to make sure that you are right in what you're saying, that you've repeated, you've tested, you know that it's reliable, you know it's robust.
On that note, are there standards in terms of lab practice and that kind of thing then?
Yeah, so absolutely. So there's the good laboratory practice that, as Claire mentioned before, when we last spoke about, they have to follow. It's regulated, and it's the same in any lab. I worked in pharmacy before. We had the same standard operating procedures that you follow every single time so that you know that your methods are robust.
Chris, can I bring you in on that? As someone who's a director of studies, what are some of these practicalities that you just don't have any choice on in order to get that ability to repeat it, in order to make sure that a study isn't, to make sure a study isn't discredited? What are some of those stipulations that you just have to stick to make sure it is sound laboratory practice?
Yeah, sure. So being a GLP facility, we have a certain way of recording all the data to make sure that everything is written down properly, recorded at the time that it was done, and you can trace everything back. So that's really important. The other thing that we do is we follow guidelines. So a study type will have a specific guideline that it follows. And that has been designed with ring testing. So it's run by the OECD, and they do ring testing to design a study, and they rigor test it, and they prove whether or not it's any good. And if it is, things Donna said, if it's repeatable. When that has been designed and finally sort of agreed, that guideline is published, and it's then followed by people like us and other facilities like us. And the idea is you are really strict structure in following certain things. So you've got to get the right temperature. You've got to get the right pH if it's a water study. You've got to make sure that all of your other environmental parameters are really restrained and in the right acceptable criteria. You then need to get the right species. You can't just use any old fish species, for example. There are certain species of fish that you have to use, and they're in the guideline. You have to make sure that those fish are good and clean and healthy and, you know, reliable to test on. They're all the same size. They are, so it's really tightly controlled. Then when you've got all of those things, you've got the right ability to keep your environment correct. You've got the right species that you need to test with. The only variable that you then introduce is your test chemical. So everything else is the same. The stocking density in a tank, the number of tanks that you use, the number of replicates, depending on the study type, they're all controlled. So the only difference is your concentration of test chemical. And then you know that if you perform that test in that manner for the correct period of time, and all of those things remain in the right spec, the result you get at the end is because of your test chemical.
In fact, Chris, would you mind taking us through perhaps an example study that you've done? So what was it you were being asked to test? How did you go about it? And take us through an example, if you could.
Yeah, all right. I'll use fish because I'm the fish person here, really. fish are my preference. So we've been given, let's give you an example of a fairly straightforward one. So there's a fungicide that's applied on the field. Somebody comes to us and they say, we need to do a fish test. The first thing we do is say, are you sure you need to do a fish test? Because it's a vertebrate test. And we want to make sure, because they're licensed, they're controlled, we don't want to be testing when we don't have to. If we agree that that is the way to go, we'll then look into how the chemical behaves in the water. Is it stable? Can I just pop it in a tank and it'll stay there? We'll develop a method with chemistry so that we can give samples of the water to our chemists and they say, you dosed it correctly. You wanted 100 milligrams per litre and you got 99 milligrams per litre. Everything's good. So we do all of that first. We make sure that we're happy, that we understand how the chemical works, and then we can start the test. So I've sourced the right fish. Typically, it's rainbow trout because they're very sensitive. So if we protect the rainbow trout, then we can protect all the other fish species, typically. We'll source them from a reputable supplier that we have a good relationship with. We know they get good quality fish. We'll keep them in a quarantine period to make sure they're nice and clean and healthy. And then only then, when we know that the chemistry is good, we know how we can apply the chemical to the fish tanks, we know that the fish are good, only then do we commit to putting fish into tanks, the right number of fish, the right number of tanks, apply your chemical. Typically, that's sort of a wet preparation where you make it in a measuring cylinder and then you do a series of dilution, you know, spaced out by a spacing factor of two, typically. You add this all to the fish tanks and then you monitor everything really closely. You monitor all the water quality stuff. You look at the behavior of the fish. You're looking for any mortalities or unusual behavior. And that study might run for 4 days or it might run for 21 days. The example that
is... Jump in and ask, yeah. Why might you have those two different time periods? What's that about?
So there are, for the fish, you've got an acute tox test, which is really focusing on how deadly your chemical is. So how lethal is it, right? So it's not a very nice test, which is why you want to make sure you do it right and you only do it once. And the idea is how much of your chemical kills 50% of the fish. That's called an LC50, a lethal concentration that kills 50% of the fish. That's a very short-term study because it's not very nice and it's the most tightly regulated study that we do. The alternative, if it's a 21-day or even a 28-day or 35-day test, for example, might be an early life stage test. So the acute test is on juvenile fish that's sort of the length of your index finger. The early life stage test is using embryos, freshly laid eggs. And what you want to do for there is you want to see less lethal. You want to look at sublethal effects. Do they grow? Do they develop properly? Is there any impact on the weight or the length of the fish by the end of the test? So you're looking sort of at more of a population level effect of your chemical. And then the third group is endocrine activity. So if you've got like pharmaceuticals, so if people are, they might be on the pill or something like that. And then that goes into the river. And we know that that's an estrogenic compound. So it feminizes fish or anything else that it comes into contact with. There are groups of chemicals that we want to make sure whether they are endocrine active or not. And in that case, you don't want to kill the fish. You want to see, do they breed properly? And that's looking at a real population level effect rather than the acute tox effect.
Thank you. So, Chris, what do you do with your results? You've done the test, you've gathered your results. Where does it go from there?
So we'll compile it all. We'll get it all thoroughly checked. Okay. That's most important, is that we enter the data correctly and we get it all checked. Yeah. And then being GLP, you have a final layer of checking, which is called quality assurance. And then when that's all done, we will then give it back to the sponsor and we'll say, I've done this test. I'm really happy with how it went. Everything was valid. The data is good. And then they'll get the data back. And then they will go with that data to the regulator for a risk assessment. It'll go into a risk assessment package. And the regulator will say, your LC50 is too high. You need to reduce your chemical, or you can't have your chemical, for example. Or if it's an early life stage test, they might say, actually, we're seeing something here. We might need to trigger a different test. And this is what Claire was mentioning earlier on. There are, depending on the compound, where it might be used, and depending on the results of the compound, you might sort of trigger a different branch of study types.
I was going to ask, Claire, a study has come out, there's this data, it's been checked, it's been verified. What are the potential impacts in our society and in our country of these studies that you do?
So as Chris said, they'll take that study and they'll plug it into their risk assessment or give it as part of a dossier to the regulators. And they might say, actually, no, you can't have your chemical on the market anymore. And the impact of that could be that, you know, farmers aren't growing spring oil seed rape anymore. So everybody would have heard of the neonicotinoids. They are toxic to bees, and therefore there's no seed coatings for oil seed rape anymore to get rid of a particular pest. And the impact of that.
Can I just clarify, when you say seed coatings, is that a chemical that's literally brushed onto the outside of the seed to prevent?
Yes.
Okay.
It's coated on like a shell, like you know those peanuts that you get with like the chili crunchy shell. They look a bit like that. Just put it into the real world context. But they will coat that on thoroughly to the end. That would remain active when the oilseed rape is flowering.
And that's been banned. That's not
neonics are not allowed anymore. There are a few. They're allowed on sugar beet in some scenarios because sugar beet doesn't flower. So the bees are not feeding on it, but it was coming through to the bees and obviously doing some damage. So they've removed those from the market. And the impact is that nobody grows spring oilseed rape anymore. People grow winter oilseed rape, but they're not able to protect from those spring insect pests. Therefore, you don't really see it anymore. So there's a food-based impact in terms of we've got to feed the country. You know, we have to balance this out. I'm not saying that we should be using those compounds, but that's where our data goes to make those decisions. And there are, Chris was referring to a fungicide. So the particular fungicide, maybe it's applied weekly. So there'll be things like potato blight, where if you don't apply it every 7 to 10 days, you'll lose your whole potato crop. And it might be that in an ideal world, the chemical manufacturer says you should be applying this 10 times in the season. But actually, we'll do the study and the study says, it's okay if you do it 5 times. But actually, if you do go to 10, then you're stressing that environment so much more. So then the manufacturer has to think cleverly about, do they reduce the amount of product per application? Do they do still 10 applications to kind of protect it for a longer period of time? But do they do 50% of the chemical each time so that you're only using the same amount over the total period, and therefore the impact is the same on the environment and is acceptable? Or do they reduce it and say you can only apply that 5 times in a season? And all of those constraints are put on the farmers. So sort of in a, I suppose, real world context is we can influence the chemicals that are on the market, or our data influences the chemicals that are on the market. What will happen? I think I mentioned earlier, we use a standard range of species. So there's a, as Chris mentioned, rainbow trout, sensitive species. If you protect them, you protect all the others. But actually, rainbow trout show up to be very, very sensitive. And the chemical manufacturer thinks that potentially that not all the other fish are that sensitive. So they might do something where they'll test actually another 3 or 4 species of fish, just so that they understand more of the environmentally relevant scenario, because rainbow trout are not everywhere. So maybe it's more relevant to test brown trout and carp, sticklebacks, something like that. And so then they'll put that data together as a package and try to understand, can we change the risk assessment based on having this more environmentally relevant data? And I think that's where a lot of companies are going. We can't pass our risk assessment on the standard stuff. So we need to better understand it so that we know whether we can still use it or we can use it at a lower level. Because at the moment, farmers can't produce the food without it. So
I find that very, very interesting. It's not just about a yes or no. And it's interesting, it's not just about testing the chemical, but you mentioned earlier on that it's about how you apply the chemical. It's about when you apply the chemical. I didn't realise that at all. So it's not just people in a lab putting things in petri dishes. It's looking very much at the context and how it works and where it works. That's fascinating. Thank you ever so much to all of you for joining me today. I've definitely learned a lot today that I didn't even consider. So thank you ever so much again to Claire, to Chris and to Donna. And thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.